Hello, and welcome to The Daily Brew, your source for news and information on everything from art and entertainment, philosophy and psychology, social trends, and a plethora of other diverse topics vital in understanding the nature of human existence. I like to remain as unbiased and open as possible when discussing a topic as nuanced as the psychology of the individual, a psychology that directly corresponds with that of their nation. Life imitates art in this sense because we formulate most of our actions by what is known as a value of self-fulfillment. It is imperative to consider the potentiality of the individual to commit acts solely in the interest of furthering their self-fulfillment. You know, most of us do this every day in many different ways, whether it's choosing specific types of toothpaste, shampoo, brands of clothing, rather than the pantheon of other selections, or the way we conduct ourselves around specific people in the confines of whatever dominance hierarchy we inhabit, or the type of job we seek, the type of food we eat, the type of image we maintain on our social media. Why must we be so specific? Specific about almost every facet of our waking life, as if it was ordained to be so. Do we reject the inherent chaos lying dormant in every single one of us? You know, with the exception being those who fit into a specific category of behavioral pathology. But that's a conversation for a different episode. No, being specific about your subjectivity, albeit monotonous in some aspects, is fundamental in maintaining consistent self-fulfillment. We cannot be anything without the mediation of our culture, our family, acquaintances, and more importantly, ourselves. But when does being this specific about our subjectivity become dangerous? Well, I believe we have a perfect example of this, and it will be the somewhat basis of discussion for this episode. The case of Jussie Smollett, while not as fresh in the collective conscious, is still a polarizing topic nonetheless. And now even more so with the recent developments brought to our attention recently, as Mr. Smollett has been indicted on 16 felony counts of disorderly conduct, an implication that could mean years behind bars if convicted. It doesn't seem real, to be honest with you guys, how insane this is. I mean, how insane is this? A man beloved for his role as Jamal Lyon, a seminal character in the hit series Empire, a show which I have been following since the time it premiered, could do something like this. But we'll start here. What struck me immediately about Jussie was his ability to encapsulate every aspect of Jamal, inside and out. This man, for all intents and purposes, is, or should I say was, Jamal Lyon, the middle child of Lucius and Cookie Lyon, brilliantly portrayed by Terrence Howard and Taraji P. Henson, both Academy Award-nominated actors, respectively. You see, understanding Jamal Lyon's motivation is somewhat useful in understanding his real-life counterpart, who allegedly fabricated a hate crime in the hopes of raising his salary and to promote an outpour of public sympathy towards him, his cause, and outright demonization of anyone who would dare to stand in opposition of it. Because why would they? But I digress. Back to Jamal Lyon for a moment. In the show, Jamal Lyon is a brilliantly gifted singer and prolific songwriter who quite literally transmutes his own turmoil and personal anguish into transparent, powerful, and beautiful displays of musicality and performance. But he is also human. He struggles with his addictions and demons, the same as everyone else. Well, maybe not the same as those who can't afford access to the substances and lifestyle qualities his line of work allots him. But nonetheless, he is one of the most transparent characters in Empire. And there's a moment in the show, during a rendition of his song Good Enough, we are shown for the first time the full extent of the cruelty he was subject to at the hands of his father, Lucius. He He makes a grand entrance in the middle of a dinner party, sporting high heels and strutting in a rather animated fashion. Now, it's not sufficient to say that he was aware of his homosexuality at that time, as it is never specified in the show. But obviously, this is his attempt at self-individuation and expression, aimed at inciting a reaction from his parents. Perhaps not the reaction he expected or wanted, as his runway show is abruptly halted by Lucius when he's picked up, brought outside, and literally thrown in the trash. While this action is highly questionable in its authenticity to real life, it's not too improbable to assume that someone has experienced this as well at some point in time, maybe to an even harsher severity than in the show. So, with this revelation now in the forefront of our thoughts on the character, what reaction did this elicit from you? Were you horrified? Angered? Disgusted? Appalled? These specific words are synonymous with our thoughts on a hate crime. Can we truly hate someone without first judging the contents of their character before making such a rash decision? Yes, of course we can. We're capable of anything if pushed far enough. But that's an intrinsic quality of the human condition, or so it seems. Jamal is roughly 11 or 12 years old, a very delicate age in life when this event occurs. This is about the time when you begin to become aware of your own subjectivity. The dichotomy of subjectivity and objectivity is now accessible to your interpretation, almost, in the sense that you understand that the thoughts others have of you indefinitely provides you with the very essence you attribute to your being. Now, with that in mind, what do you think occurred inside Jamal's head when this happened? Well, he's telling us in the lyrics of the song Good Enough. He sings, "What do I gotta do? I just want you to look at me and see that I can be what you love. I just want you to look at me and see that I can be good enough." Those are powerful words to say to your father, when in reality, shouldn't a son be good enough to his father, regardless of who he is and the things he chooses to do with his life, and not fear this harsh persecution like Jamal does? It's kind of hard to think that when your own father throws you away like garbage for expressing yourself. And while yes, there is an argument to be made about young Jamal's actions, it's hard to determine what warrants a reaction quite like the one Lucius displayed. I don't think there could be justification in it. In another part of the song, he sings, "I'll never be big enough to pay your dues." Dues that must be paid lest he fear being disposed of in the primordial trash can of existence. Fate worse than death, in my opinion. Jamal, now scarred by his father's rejection and malice, vows to never be thrown away by anyone other than himself. Because believe me, we attempt to throw ourselves out in preference of a better version of ourselves all the time. Jamal's case is no different, just in circumstances. But even then, he is still a broken person, rejected by his father, the man who is supposed to protect him and teach him right from wrong. What implication does that mean for him? A life of consistently seeing yourself as a means to your own end. And if this means is not compatible with the end you desire, what then does that mean? It means a perpetual pattern of self-deprecation and needless, emotionally satisfying decadence. What do you think Jamal is trying to say when he sings, "I'll never be big enough to pay your dues"? He means, "I will be solely responsible for my undoing." He has encountered firsthand the utter absurdity of life. He understands that he lives in a world where a father can dispose of his child solely on the basis of not agreeing with a lifestyle choice. What type of fate is that? What is this crazy world we're living in? Why is this allowed to happen? because we are never big enough to pay everyone's dues. Take the dues he owes to his father, for example. Complete submission to his expectations and to act accordingly under his guidelines. You know, most of us would be inclined to do so because of the amount of reverence we feel for our parents at that age. You know, we idle at their almost godlike ingenuity and understanding of this strange world. But what happens to those who cannot easily adhere to such standards? Oftentimes when this happens, the individual can spend the rest of their life in resentment towards their parents, and will struggle to maintain the consistent self-image, self-worth, self-meaning, self-value, and most of all, self-fulfillment. You know, all these that are needed to live a healthy existence, you know, with the latter being the most dangerous of those uncertainties by far, because by and large, most of us seek self-fulfillment above all else. And we achieve this through many different means. Jamal Lyon, for example, achieves self-fulfillment through music. So he lives his life as a means for his music's end. He becomes what he creates because he has always been his own creation. The sum of his own actions, thoughts, motivations, and shortcomings. Jamal, in spite of his father, refuses to record and tour despite his incredible talent. That is until his mother begins to manage his career. This is intentional character development. It's a metaphor for Jamal. In believing that listening to his father will only get him tossed out like yesterday's leftovers, Cookie for him represents salvation, acceptance, fulfillment. His archetype for a mother. It was Cookie who salvaged him from the garbage. It was Cookie who encouraged him to tour and to record the album that would eventually transform him into a global superstar. And it was Cookie who gave him the confidence needed to leave, of his own volition, the comfort of his father's fabricated world. Jamal now knows his purpose. It's nothing special, it's the same as the rest of us. But Jamal no longer tries to deny its existence. Fully embracing his will to power, Jamal now seeks unbridled self-fulfillment. Now that we more or less understand Jamal's motivation, without getting into every minute detail in the show, we can now shift our attention to the man responsible for providing this character its essence. Jussie Smollett, born June 21st, 1982, in Santa Rosa, California, to Jeanette and Joel Smollett. In eerie contrast to his on-screen counterpart, he is also a middle child, with him being the third of six siblings in total. Smollett is biracial, with his mother being of African descent and his father of Jewish. Smollett found a flair for acting early on in life, appearing in films such as The Mighty Ducks and North in 1992 and 1994, respectively. He even landed a stint on a television show alongside his fellow siblings. But it wouldn't be until 2012's The Skinny, a candid look at the daily life of young, gay, black men in America, would Smollett return to the big screen. With the limited reception of the film not yielding him much in the way of fame and recognition, other than a couple more appearances on television shows like Revenge and The Mindy Project, it seems Smollett's career would remain at a stalemate until 2014, which saw Smollett cast in the aforementioned show Empire as Jamal Lyon, a role that would catapult him into the realm of myths almost. With rare time since Nelson Ellis, whose portrayal of the openly gay character Lafayette in the show True Blood, had there really been a prominent analogous portrayal of an openly gay black man that held a prominent spot in the collective conscious? This was a monumental commitment in some respects for Smollett. How much responsibility was he given? Responsibility in the sense that he has become the measure in which black members of the LGBTQ community are represented authentically in popular culture. In the vein of overemphasizing the significance of this commitment, the universal spotlight is now on Smollett, who demonstrated this commitment very candidly with fellow Hollywood socialites Raven Simone and company on an episode of The View in 2017. Flying high off his recent Golden Globe nomination for his seminal role in Empire, spirits are high and playful in this interview, where Smollett reminisces through memories from his formative years to his recent endorsement deals with Pepsi, and acting almost as a sort of satyr from a Greek chorus, he indulges us on the inner world the Lyon family is still immersed in, as this is a crucial time in the show, where peace, if it could ever be called such, is at its most fragile for the Lyon family. There's an intriguing moment in the interview where Smollett begins to immerse himself in Jamal's subjective thoughts on the events of the show. It's where he begins to stutter the utterance, quote, "We'll start to see." Twice. Eyes closed, with a subtle shift in the octave of his voice, mirroring Jamal's, quote, "We'll start to see," end quote. There's significance in that utterance. "We'll start to see. We'll start to see." Can we even call him Jussie Smollett at this point, when subjectively he has now inhabited the universality of this commitment? We're hanging on his every word at this point. He is our bridge to this fantasy we've all taken solace in immersing ourselves in every Wednesday night for the past 3 years at this point. He has committed us with him. Fast forward 2 years, January 22nd, 2019. Jussie Smollett reports an incident to the Chicago PD where he allegedly received a threatening letter sent to the Empire studio. The letter, laced with crushed powder, later determined to be Tylenol, also bared a rather disturbing image of a stick figure hanging with a gun pointed at it. Disturbing indeed, but Tylenol. Was it supposed to be taken for anthrax or something? Points for creativity, though. The fateful day arrived on January 29th, a day that made us all collectively gasp, perhaps not out of anger, but astonishment at the utter moroseness of the incident. Supposedly, Jussie Smollett files a police report. He has been attacked by his city. He, a man beloved by his city, has been brutalized on its streets. Another hate crime statistic. America is outraged. For a time, there was no media outlet, celebrity, or Twitter account that wasn't weighing in on this heinous event in some way. How polarizing. A nation shook to its very core. How could this have happened? To Jussie Smollett, of all people, a champion for the LGBTQ community around the world, supposedly beaten to a pulp, drenched in bleach, with a noose around his neck, all the while being berated with homophobic and racial slurs. With one of the attackers even yelling, quote, "This is MAGA country," end quote. How disgusting. How cruel. How senseless. How barbaric. Is this what making America great means? The systemic destruction of anyone who speaks against it and its fearless leader? These thoughts would pervade my mind indefinitely for the time being. Chicago police hastily began one of the largest and amphibious investigations in the city's history, wasting no time in identifying two persons of interest with the help of pod security footage taken the night of the alleged attack. As time goes by, more and more details from that night begin to surface. Some of these details begin to muddy the initial facticity of Jussie's statements, who up until that point was quoted as saying he has been nothing but cooperative and honest with investigators, and that his story remained consistent, even addressing the issue during his first performance after the attack at the Troubadour. An emotional Smollett said, quote, "Regardless of what anyone says, I will only stand for love. We hope that you will all stand with us," end quote. So, the tone of the investigation shifted when new information revealed that, initially, Jussie was very reluctant in reporting the incident. A friend of his actually phoned the police for him. To the officer's surprise, when they arrived at Smollett's home, he was still wearing the noose around his neck, bizarre, but nonetheless, this man was just attacked and brutalized in below freezing temperature. It's pretty safe to assume that his mental faculties were not in total equilibrium. And why should they be, for all they knew? The report goes as follows. Smollett left a Subway restaurant at around 2 a.m. when he was attacked by two men in black clothes and black ski masks. They were wearing red hats. I believe they were red hats. He was beaten, had a noose placed around his neck, and was then covered in bleach, all the while being taunted with homophobic and racial slurs. Smollett allegedly managed to ward off his attackers. There were details that just weren't adding up, as in, how was he able to actively defend himself against two stout men in freezing cold weather? Pain is amplified in the cold, but not only that, why did he still have the noose around his neck? Smollett explains that he did this because he wanted everyone to see, you know, what he was reduced to, as if that image alone wasn't enough to burn itself into our minds. And why was he reluctant to report the attack? It's not like he knew these people, right? He was never going to see them again, except maybe from the witness stand. He had literally no reason not to report it. He was inclined to report it, actually. But I won't lie, this was all starting to seem like the premise for an episode of Empire. Now, whether or not that was the product of this hyper-connected world we live in, or some mystical synchronicity is beyond me. Things made almost too much sense, by Smollett's account, that is. It was polished, it was sharp, it was damning in its eminence. But the question remained the same. Who were these attackers, and will they be found? Well, the men and women of the Chicago PD worked tirelessly in search for that answer. And unbeknownst to all of us, they had that answer. You see, they had been tracking these two men for quite some time and already put names to faces and were now days away from making an arrest, as they had learned that the men had fled the country immediately after the attack and were due to arrive back in the States from Nigeria on February 13th. They got their guys right on schedule. The two men are identified as the Osundario brothers, and they had some things to say to detectives. While this separate reality was unfolding, Smollett gave an exclusive interview to anchor Robin Roberts, where he went into detail about his attack and addressed the growing doubt in the legitimacy of his claims. But we'll get back to that later. February 15th. The Osundario brothers are now in custody, with what was supposed to be an entire litany of charges racking up against the two now ensuing, but something interesting happened. Quite the opposite from what I had anticipated by a long shot, and even that would be an understatement, because like I said, guys, I was fooled. Totally, completely duped. I was committed. The Osundario brothers made a shocking claim. They knew Smollett. Not only did they know him, one of them was an extra on Empire, the other a workout buddy, supposedly. By nightfall, in an unprecedented turn of events, the Osundarios are released from custody, with the Chicago PD announcing the two are no longer suspects in the investigation and will receive no charges. And now they were, quote, eager to speak with Jussie Smollett, end quote. In a twist, that very same night, we received word from Smollett's legal team that Smollett was in pure disbelief that the brothers could have had any involvement whatsoever. On February 17th, we received a new revelation. Not only did the Osundarios know Smollett, but in fact, they were paid to stage this attack and catch it on camera. Hence wearing all black and completely inconspicuous ski masks that they were actually caught on camera purchasing. What the hell is going on here? What am I supposed to believe right now, honestly? The implications that were surfacing in my mind were beguiling, to say the least. How am I supposed to believe that this incredible man who preaches nothing but love, tolerance, acceptance, and equality to millions of people around the world would violate his own creed? His own tenant by committing the ultimate act of deception? Did his words mean nothing? Is this what he thought of us? Reactions? It sure started to feel like it. As my alienation grew, I began to really think about the utter absurdity of this whole story, and how there were cracks permeating through every layer of it, inconsistencies right from the beginning. Was that threatening letter even real? And if it wasn't, who sent it? Did he send it? Why? For attention? How would this in any way constitute a raise and an already substantial salary he already receives per episode? Is it because of his commitment to the show, to his character, to his fans? Or even more sinister, was it all a game? A real-life performance of Empire playing out in reality, where Jamal would be indoctrined into the pantheon of hate crimes that occur every day, to maintain his relevance and the potency of his public persona? Do these questions even matter now? We'll see. February 20th, in a move that has since left the country bewildered, Jesse Smollett is arrested and charged with felony disorderly conduct for filing a false police report. Now, all we're left with is questions at this point. You know, even though it seems the time for questioning has already ended, you know, we received our answer. It was deafening in its ambivalence. We cannot be certain of too much at this moment. We can only deal in speculation. But what if his standing with his compatriots at the Empire Studio? It would seem that feelings were ambivalent on that front as well, with the cast and crew decisively divided on opinion, with the latter showing the most disdain towards these developments. But I suppose that's to be expected, with Fox officials stating, quote, "We understand the seriousness of this matter and we respect the legal process. We are evaluating the situation and are considering our options." End quote. This was following the emotional public address given by Chicago PD Superintendent Eddie Johnson. March 8th. As if the final nail in the coffin of this litany of transgressions has finally been driven in, a grand jury would indict Jesse Smollett with 16 counts of felony disorderly conduct. The first set of charges related to the initial police report, while the second focused mainly on the second interview he gave with detectives. Jesse Smollett, what exactly was going on in his mind? What could have possibly influenced his decision-making? Well, a recent revelation I've become aware of is his supposed untreated addiction to the drug MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy. This could be crucial in determining his mental state throughout this whole affair. MDMA, scientifically termed 3,4-methylene dioxy in methamphetamine, in short, is characterized by its ability to react with certain neurotransmitters in the brain, increasing the output of serotonin, stimulating the amygdala. The amygdala being the cluster of nuclei or gray matter that situate opposite sides of both cerebral hemispheres. Associated effects of MDMA include euphoria, increased sex drive, synesthesia in higher doses, increased empathy, highly suggestive states of mind. This effect in particular is being studied in clinical trials as a means to treat patients with particularly bad cases of PTSD. But anyways, those are but a few of MDMA's effects on the brain's neurological structures, not even including the unpleasant comedown that is often associated with it. It often requires abstinence from this substance for about 3 months to regain full equilibrium in the brain's neurostructures, this being in the way that the amygdala is able to function correctly without synthetic forms of stimulation, so that it may properly regulate our responses to external stimuli in a healthy and balanced manner. The amygdala is quite fascinating due to each of them containing its own unique memory system, with the right regulating negative emotions and the left regulating positive emotions and negative emotions as well. Interestingly enough, with all this in mind, I'd like to point out another point of interest pertaining to the question I asked earlier on what could have affected his decision making. We may actually have an answer. Before I go any further into this analysis, I'd like to make it very clear that this is in no way an attempt to slander or deface Jussie Smollett in any way. This is merely a subjective hypothesis from information gathered in the hopes of us bringing another dimension of perspective to the table before we totally condemn this man into oblivion, because honestly, it probably is going to happen, but on the off chance it doesn't, and we can find the time to recognize a semblance of humanity in this situation, then I believe we as a society will be better off. Because not only is this a crime, one of moral conjecture, but also political. So let's not throw the baby out with the crib on this one. A bit of psychological insight is necessary in avoiding such a catastrophe. The motives have to go a little different, or a little deeper than mere dissatisfaction and salary or publicity stunt. No, this owes its conception in the realm of a particular pathology. Allegedly, this crime was planned and orchestrated, showing clear motive and intent on a particular outcome. This attack was predicated under the guise of hate and malevolence towards three members of three distinct groups: members of the Black community, members of the LGBTQ community, and members of MAGA ideals and fundamentals, under which is characterized by our acting president. This crime owes its origin in the area of a specific behavioral pathology, one that is associated with self-gratification, lack of empathy, and inflated self-image. Now, we could actually draw two different pathologies from the different characteristics, or the following characteristics. One is narcissistic personality disorder, the other is sociopathy. In no way am I accusing or am I excusing the severity of this alleged crime, or am I making these presuppositions from a place of malice? The problem with episodes like these is that it's very easy to misinterpret what is being said out of context. So with that being said, back to the idea of these two particular pathologies arising from Smollett's increased use of MDMA because of the taxing effects on the structure of the amygdala. And since the amygdala's role in the overall neurological structure of the brain is to regulate our perception of fear and other emotions, including anger, sadness, happiness, and empathy. Empathy in particular, because of its close proximity to the hippocampus. The hippocampus is most thought to be the center force behind the autonomic nervous system. Interesting fact about the autonomic nervous system is that researchers actually conduct studies examining the activity in the hippocampus, and oftentimes these results are pretty accurate in determining a person's chance of exhibiting psychopathic or sociopathic tendencies. Because narcissism is intrinsically based on as a characteristic in both psychopathy and sociopathy. We will move forward in this analysis with this as a presupposed notion in the case. The only theory that holds any merit, in my opinion, that due to Jussie Smollett's demanding schedule, performing and filming commitments, increased and unchecked use of drugs like MDMA, a substance that drastically alters neurological structures, and re-emphasizing his commitment, it would seem that what we have here is the development of a latent form of sociopathy or narcissistic personality disorder. Excluding psychopathy on the grounds that psychopaths are born and not made, unlike sociopaths or narcissists, like psychopaths, most sociopaths are narcissists. They have a very grandiose view of themselves and a difficulty in regulating self-esteem. The only difference is narcissists and sociopaths feel shame and empathy, somewhat, to a certain degree. The act of being caught in a lie, for example, will usually elicit a strong emotional response from the narcissist or the sociopath. Not out of guilt for having transgressed in some way, but more so because they were caught. The sociopath is marked with a high level of impulsivity, and at times distortions in rational decision-making. planning a staged hate crime with the intention of national attention and a certain level of scrutiny being placed upon a group of people, this being the people who identify chiefly with MAGA ideology, requires a certain element of detachment. Detachment from the possible consequences, mostly, in order to even consider attempting something like this. Another area of interest about the narcissist is the denial of truth, and emphasis on the truth as a means of justification for reproach in any way. This is something that Jussie Smollett slightly exhibited during his interview with Robin Roberts. In the interview, he sits very stiffly upright with his hands cupped in his lap. Roberts asks, quote, "What is it that has you so angry? Is it the attackers?" End quote. She's cut off in her question by Smollett's immediate response, quote, "It's the attacks, but not just the attacks. It's like, you know, first it's like a thing of like, listen, if I tell the truth, then that's it, because it's the truth. Then it became a thing of like, oh, how can you doubt that? How do you not believe that? It's the truth. And then it became a thing of like, oh, it's not necessarily that you don't believe that this is the truth. You don't even want to see the truth." End quote. A lot to unpack in that response. A common hallmark of covert narcissism is the tactic to play on a certain insecurity, or switch the blame on someone using a difficult subject, such as a hate crime, as a means to disarm a conversation and switch it in the narcissist's favor by playing into that insecurity that most people have about their moral integrity. In this case, it's, I'm saying it was a hate crime. This is supposed to be taken seriously. How can you possibly not believe that? You can't do that. As a supposed victim, I am allotted the benefit of the doubt 10 out of 10 times, because that's just what's morally just. And if you don't, then you're a part of the problem. No one wants to be a part of the problem. This and many other telling signs in the interview served only to increase public doubt in the merit of his claims. And rightly so, because the story is already wrought with inconsistencies. One of the biggest ones is, how was he even coherent enough to fight his attackers after being sucker punched in below freezing weather? And that's not me calling Jussie weak or anything. It's just highly unlikely anyone could keep their composure in those circumstances, regardless of physicality. There's a part where he says fighting 3 times in a row. Seemed too rehearsed to me for some reason. He explains that they started tussling for a bit, and he ends up on the ground. And then everything stops. The attackers run off. Seems highly contradictory of the claim he made about fighting them off early in the interview. He says it felt like minutes, but that's impossible. A minute of continuous physical altercation would render an individual incapacitated, especially in the freezing weather of that cold January night. There's not enough fragility in the story, if that makes sense. One of the most damning claims he makes is the one about him not being aware at any point during the fight that a noose was being placed on his neck, or having bleach dumped on him. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You don't just not notice a noose being placed around your neck, right? Or having a liquid poured on you. Its impact is expounded on exponentially by the cold weather. In his bewilderment, he manages to find his phone, work up the coherency to explain to his manager what has happened, and remain in composure despite supposedly screaming when he noticed the noose around his neck. When Robin Roberts asks him how long did all this take place, his response is revealing in a few ways. He says, quote, "It felt like minutes, but it was probably only 30 seconds. Honestly, I can't tell you. Honestly." End quote. Very telling. Could be a Freudian slip. So many unanswered questions. What then was he expecting to result from all this? Say, hypothetically speaking, he succeeds in eluding detection and this ploy for attention, acquisition of a salary raise, fulfills its commitment. Well, what implications would that mean? Would we have seen a rise in the number of hate crimes? Would this incite some kind of response from the 1,000 or so hate groups active in this country already? Or would this have been met with a dutiful and almost chauvinistic retaliation? Because think about it. A member of the black community, a citizen of the United States, an individual, a human being, was mercilessly assaulted, taunted, and exploited by the very symbol which still is synonymous with the persecution and displacement of the members of the black community in this country for hundreds of years. But this response would not just come from the black community, but every other activist group, well-to-do politicians, and finally even the President of the United States to address this issue as a fatal illness to which no antibiotic could render completely benign. Benign as in it exists, but the systemic spreading of that ideology is kept contained within the confines of secret societies, deep web literature, or, you know, it could remain esoteric in a sense, like small followings not organized or committed well enough to implicate any manifesto they happen to come in contact with. But that's not the point, really. The point, returning to Jussie Smollett, is still the question of what were his intentions, and how was this act to aid him in his overall act of doing, which is self-fulfillment, rather than being. We'll get into that later. Being, which is recognizing wholly that you are truly judged by actions and the appearances those actions bring about in other people's minds. That's why this event is profound in so many ways. A chain of events it could have set off, the direction Empire might have gone, where Smollett's career could have gone, the future of the existence of hate groups in this country, public opinion on MAGA. The list is endless, almost. That could be addressed on a later episode, maybe. In the meantime, stay tuned for my somewhat in-depth series on the philosophy of existential psychoanalysis and why it could prove to be the most effective form of therapy for the passive nihilism which seems to be so inextricably woven into numerous aspects of our thinking. More so in the thoughts of the younger generations. But really, I always welcome feedback. And guests who would like to be interviewed or just call in for a conversation or a little civil discourse on something you might not agree with. Just leave me a message on my Anchor account or a Facebook message. My name is Ryder. R-Y-D-R. Probably the only one you'll see with that name. But please feel free. Civil discourse is truly the mechanism that corrects dogmatic and totalitarian excesses which sometimes occupy themselves in specific ideologies. Now, this doesn't mean that the ideology or the follower of it should be persecuted in any way without careful analysis and complete knowledge of that ideology within the context which brought about its origin. All of that before we do anything rash. Because, as it has been shown many times in the past, conflict happens on the level of thesis and antithesis, without getting too Hegelian on you. What results is not usually or ethically a complete victory of either side, but rather a synthesis of that thesis and antithesis, correcting each other's excesses and misunderstandings to come to a more reasonable and symbiotic cooperation for the necessity of survival. Will the happiness of others in the way you will your own. That's all you can do. Thank you for listening. This has been The Daily Brew. I'll talk to you next time.